Hello, everyone. Before we start today's podcast, some exciting news for you. You can experience the Inside Politics podcast live in Dublin on May 16th when Hugh Linehan, Jennifer Bray and I will be joined by Cliff Young of Ipsos, one of America's top pollsters, to talk about the US election, our own local and European elections and much more. It's a breakfast event kicking off at 8 a.m. in Trinity College. If you'd like to attend, you can get tickets at irishtimes.com/events. That's irishtimes.com/events. I hope we see lots of you there.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
It's Wednesday, April the 24th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. We haven't had a look at UK politics for a while, but there's plenty of interesting stuff happening there at the moment as the country winds down or gears up. Take your pick to the general election, which will be taking place later this year, but there are other local and other elections taking place before that. Interesting developments both in London and in Scotland. We wanted to look at all of that today with Mark Paul, our London correspondent. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Hugh. How are you?
I'm very good. Maybe we just go to the main story of the week in London so far this week, which is the passing by the House of Lords of this Rwanda bill, which seemed to have been stuck in limbo forever.
Yeah, so I mean, look, this week has actually been, surprise of surprises, actually quite a good week for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. And as you say, the Rwanda bill was passed late in the night on Monday night. I was at a press conference in Downing Street on that Monday morning, and it was clear that Rishi Sunak was kind of setting it up for a kind of a faux battle, I suppose, between himself and the House of Lords. I mean, he was feigning this whole, very annoyed and kind of truculent demeanour, and he was using kind of very schoolmasterly language, like, we're going to sit as long as it takes. No ifs, no buts. This legislation has to be passed tonight. And in the end, the Lords just gave up. I mean, opposition in the House of Lords to this Rwanda bill had been mainly, it had been Labour peers, but there were also a lot of crossbench peers who were opposed to it. And there were two main sticking points in the end. One was over this Rwanda bill, which allows Britain, when it gets royal assent, when it is finally passed, it will allow Britain to deport illegal migrants to Rwanda, where their asylum claims will be done and where they will claim asylum there. But the bill declares Rwanda a safe country for this, and there was opposition to that in the House of Lords. And the other aspect of opposition was some of the Lords were looking for an exception for Afghans who had served and helped the British military, and because Afghans are jointly with Vietnamese people the biggest group of people who claim asylum in Britain. So the Lords made their last stand on these two points, and eventually they folded. I mean, it had been going on for weeks either side of Easter, what they call parliamentary ping pong, which is where a bill is bounced between the House of Lords and the House of Commons until they finally come to an arrangement, and then it is passed. But it has been passed. It isn't law yet. It needs to get a royal assent from King Charles, which is only a formality this week. And then it looks like Britain's first flights to Rwanda, according to Rishi Sunak's Downing Street press conference on Monday morning, should take place in 10 to 12 weeks, or sometime in July.
There's a number of ways of looking at this legislation. Some people see it as unacceptable on humanitarian grounds. Some people, as you say, suggest that it might be in breach of international law because of this question of Rwanda being a safe country. Some people say it's just not going to work, and some people say it's going to be incredibly expensive and it's not going to work. I suppose all that remains to be seen, does it?
All that remains to be seen. All of that is in the mix. And then there's another possible angle to it, which is how it actually impacts UK domestic politics. I mean, as you say, immigration and illegal immigration and asylum is and has been for years, long since pre-Brexit, a big political issue. So there was always a sense that he was going to have to try and do something, and whether or not this will work is one thing. But what it could do is there's a kind of a growing sentiment over here that there's a possibility that it could lead to an early election, because, the plan seems to be for Rishi Sunak to hold a general election late in the year, perhaps in October or November. But there's always a chance that the European Court of Human Rights, the court in Strasbourg that Britain is a part of through a treaty that it has signed, could try and block these Rwanda flights. And if it does, there's a sense that Rishi Sunak might be tempted at that stage to call an early election going into the summer, perhaps in June or July when flights are due to take off. So there's a lot happening around Rwanda, a lot of things happening that aren't specifically and solely to do do with the issue of migration itself. It's very much, as well as being a policy issue and an immigration issue, it's very much a political issue. And of course, you mentioned then the very salient question is, will it actually work? I mean, we're heading into the summer now, you know, when small boat season, as they call it here, kicks off in earnest. Whilst that press conference was going on Monday morning in Downing Street, the Home Office, very, very sneakily, were slipping out statistics to show that small boat arrivals in the UK were actually up 24% so far this year, which kind of eats into Rishi Sunak's insistence that his plan, his overall migration plan, is working. So migration, the movement of people, illegal immigration and legal immigration, all of these issues together are still probably the biggest issue facing Rishi Sunak, and they may well be the platform upon which he chooses to fight the next general election.
So if the European Court of Human Rights becomes an issue, is that purely because Sunak might see it as the best ground on which to fight an election? Or is it because of divisions in his own party? Because I understand, I listened to him, he's quite careful in his wording when he's asked about this question. He basically just affirms his complete confidence that this is fully in accordance with international law and moves swiftly along to the next question. Because there would be problems in his own ranks should the Tories, for example, go to the country on the basis of withdrawing from the European Court of Human Rights?
That's absolutely right. There are two camps in the Tory party, one which are gung-ho for withdrawing from the European Court of Human Rights, and the other camp, more the kind of one-nation centrist, soft, wet kind of Tories, who say, look, if you pull out of the European Court of Human Rights, that it will be a big problem for them. Rishi Sunak was the most explicit on this issue that I've ever heard him on Monday. He said, no foreign court will stop this. And if it's a choice between our membership of a foreign court, he used those words, if it's a choice between our membership of a foreign court and the Rwanda bill, I will choose the Rwanda bill. So that was, to me, a pretty explicit statement that if Strasbourg, if the European Court of Human Rights, in some way tries to either strike this legislation down or stop the flights even, without even striking down the legislation, pausing the flights, suspending them, that Rishi Sunak would use that to pull out of the European Court of Human Rights. And then you might find yourself in an early election because he might lose the support of those one nation Tories. And he might say, look, this is now a single issue election. I'm trying to push through this legislation. I'm going to go to the country. A foreign court is stopping me. I can't get the support of everybody in my party. Back me or sack me.
I've seen some suggestions and some polling to suggest that Sunak may not be entirely right that this is the best issue, but maybe given his pretty dire situation politically, it's the least worst issue for him to go to the country on. I mean, the small boats pledge was one of five pledges that he made when he came into power. We don't hear very much about the other four anymore.
No, you don't, because he's failing on pretty much all, with the exception of inflation. He said that he would have inflation. Now, inflation obviously isn't completely in his gift. It's the Bank of England sets interest rates. But inflation is down, and certainly some of his policies have contributed to that. But you're right in that immigration and migration isn't the number one issue for the whole country. It's funny in that it's probably, when you look at the rankings of different issues in terms of their importance to voters, and those rankings are available quite regularly, the issue is very, very important. The issue of migration and legal immigration is very important to people up in the north of England, which ironically is hundreds and hundreds of miles away from where the problem actually takes place, which is down on the beaches of southeast England. The NHS and the economy overall and the cost of living are generally higher in the rankings for most people. So look, an argument for going long on an election, for not having a summer election and for waiting until October or November, is that there's a chance then that the economy would start to improve more and people would feel it in their pockets, and it would allow them to fight an election then, I suppose, with two green ticks beside his name. One on the migration thing, from his point of view, and the other one on that, you know, inflation is down, the cost of living isn't quite the massive problem that it was when I first moved to Britain in January of last year, when at that time it was literally everything that everybody talked about all of the time. That has died away now. There is some wriggle room there in the UK's fiscal position for potential tax cuts. They've already brought in £900 worth of tax cuts for your average person through national insurance since late last year. So look, Rishi Sunak isn't in a great place, obviously, when you look at the polls where him and his party are, but it's just ironic that over the last week or so, he's actually had, by his standards, quite a decent run of things in the news flow. And it's an interesting time for him, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, isn't it? It's the natural political instinct of any incumbent to hang on if they're in a sticky place, to hang on in the hope that something may get better or at least not get worse. However, I mean, looking at it from this side of the IRC, there seems to be a constant drip of kind of just stories that encapsulate the fact that the public is sick of 13 years of Conservative rule. Every week there seems to be some backbencher I've never heard of, caught with his pants down in some inappropriate situation, triggering yet another by-election. It's a kind of a sign of a party that's just heading inexorably in one direction, isn't it?
There's a smell of death off all of this. I mean, last year there was the sort of conversation in Britain, is this 1992 when the Tories pulled off a miraculous recovery, or is it 1997 when Labour wiped the floor with them? And what I always said to them when I got over, I was like, it sounds to me more like 2011 Fianna Fáil, that the public have stopped listening. It doesn't matter what you do, nothing is going to make a dent in the polls, and that once the electorate decides that it's time for a change, it's time for a change. And you're right, there's a drip, drip, drip of scandal. I mean, there are MPs losing the whip, there are former prime ministers writing books that keep reminding the electorate of the turmoil that went before. There are people who are circling around Rishi Sunak because they know that he's probably doomed after the next election and they want to be the next leader. So you have the Tory party is in a very, very disunited state, and it's very difficult to see how they can pull this out of the fire. And Labour just, it seems, just continues on with what they call their Ming Vase strategy, which is, you know, if you can just imagine Keir Starmer walking towards Downing Street holding this ancient, priceless vase, just don't drop it. Just let the other guys, get themselves into a lather. Just don't drop the vase and maybe you'll make it.
And as I said at the start, there are local elections coming up, and they're pretty significant ones, you know, because of that reform of local government that happened a bit over 10 years ago. You know, there are these mayoralties in places like the West Midlands and Teesside, actually exactly the places that Boris Johnson delivered success for the Conservative Party 4 years ago, and that Labour are now looking to regain that territory.
Yes, these local elections are on May the 2nd. They're local elections and mayoral elections. And they're important for two reasons. Obviously, the elections themselves, I mean, the Tories will want to defend their seats there, but they're also important because a really bad result in them could precipitate a heave against Rishi Sunak, and that's something that he's quite concerned about. There's about 2,600 seats in the local elections up for grabs, mainly in kind of, I suppose, Labour territory, you would say. The Tories have about 960 of those seats. They expect to lose well over half of them. So if they lose over 500 seats, there'll be some trouble for Rishi Sunak. But the mayoral elections that you refer to are very, very interesting, because they're a real bellwether of how the Tory party is defending these working class areas, as you say, that Boris Johnson won in 2019. And if they lose all of these mayoral elections, if there's a Labour wipeout on that slate, then I think there's serious trouble for Rishi Sunak in his own party. Two interesting races to watch. One is the West Midlands, where you have Andy Street, the former managing director of John Lewis department stores, a guy with a kind of a public profile in his own right. The last poll that came out put him 14 points behind. Now, days later, actually, the polling company came out and corrected that and said there was a problem in their methodology and he might not be that far behind, that he might only be 4 or 5 points behind. But still, if Andy Street loses upper end of Birmingham area, that's trouble for Rishi Sunak. And the other one to watch is the Tees Valley combined mayoralty election. And there's a guy there called Ben Houchin, he's Tory through and through, working class Tory through and through. He's in a real fight for a seat, and nobody thought that he would be. Everybody thought that he'd be fine. He's actually seen as quite an effective mayor. He's quite loyal to Rishi Sunak. But if he goes, if Ben Houchin goes and if Andy Street goes, on top of all these kind of already baked in seat losses in the local elections, then you might just get a load of people in Westminster, MPs in the Tory party, who say, look, we may as well change leader again, because what have we got to lose? There's an election coming up, we might staunch some of the losses. So look, in that situation, there could well be a vote of confidence in Rishi Sunak, which he'd actually probably be expected to win, but limp on weakly like a shot deer and leading what looks like the Tories into a very, very difficult general election at some stage in the second half of the year.
Is this not a sign, though, of the absolutely disastrous state that the party finds itself in, that they'd even be contemplating yet again, going for, what, a third prime minister in a single parliamentary term? You mentioned former leaders writing books. After the absolute disaster of Liz Truss, that surely is a sign of a party that's lost its moorings in reality.
That's certainly the sense of it. I mean, Rishi Sunak can't even govern his own party, never mind govern his own country. Look, the Tory parties are in absolute turmoil. And when you look at what, I suppose, what the party and the country has been through in their period in power, I mean, they came to power in a period of austerity in the aftermath of a financial crisis. Then there was everything around Brexit. Then there was the COVID pandemic. I mean, these are big epoch-defining events that would tire out any party. Now, they've been almost 14 years in power now. I mean, the party is very, very tired. It's not united at all. It's been split every which way on each issue. And throw into all of that, I suppose, the kind of the extra fuel around the culture wars, these relentless, soul-sapping culture wars that Britain has been through, which have also split the Tory party on all sorts of issues, from transgender issues to also the Israel-Gaza issue, which has become a culture war issue in its own right over here. It's quite obvious that that's happened. All of these things have just combined into this awful cocktail to sap the morale of the Tory party, to split it every which way but loose. And I suppose when a party is that disunited, and when they're at each other's throats all of the time, as they are in the Tory party openly, it's very, very hard to govern a country, and it's very, very hard for a party to keep on an even keel. It's a very, very difficult situation to manage. Rishi Sunak is certainly struggling to do it, but I don't know who could manage it, to be honest.
It's interesting to listen to you say that, because it strikes me that then, in opposition to that, Keir Starmer is the anti-culture war candidate, really, isn't he? He absolutely tries to just stay away in as much as he possibly can from division over Israel, Gaza, or indeed the transgender issue, or a number of other ones as well. I mean, there's the don't break them in vase strategy, but there also seems to be an inclination to try and not to use those kind of political tools.
Yes, he doesn't want to stoke it up. Now, he isn't always entirely successful in staying away from this. I mean, you mentioned Israel, Gaza. That has been a huge problem for him in terms of 80% of voters who are Muslim in Britain vote Labour, right? That is that's a well-known statistic. And there's obviously a lot of Muslim anger over how the war in Gaza has been perpetrated upon the Palestinian people. And that has been a big problem for Keir Starmer. And he's tried to contain that situation as well as he can. But you're seeing some evidence actually in the slates of candidates in the local elections that he hasn't been entirely successful. If you look at somewhere like Burnley near Manchester, a real Labour area, where a huge proportion, I think about 35 to 40% of the voters are actually Muslim. There are no Asian Muslim candidates on the slate at all for Labour in that area, which is highly, highly unusual, because an awful lot of Muslim people are withdrawing their support for the party. So Keir Starmer, whilst he tries with his Ming Wei strategy to stay away from all these items of controversy, he isn't always successful. He doesn't go looking for these issues, but sometimes they come looking for him, and it's not always possible to avoid it. But so far, he seems to be doing a reasonable job of keeping his party together in all of these. Look, the Labour Party has its own problems, but the polls and the opinion polls aren't one of them. I mean, they're way ahead. You know, unless something extraordinary happens, they should be in government after the next general election. But Keir Starmer still has some managing of his party to do before then, I think.
And his deputy leader has some issues at the moment. There's a kind of long-running story about allegations that she didn't pay appropriate tax on one of her dwellings.
Yes, Angela Rayner, the deputy leader of the party, who's actually in an elected position, so she can't be removed by Keir Starmer even if he wanted to. Not that there's any evidence that he does want to. But yes, it goes back to her living arrangements, which seems like a very petty thing. But it also goes to the heart of whether or not she's telling the truth. And that, I think, is the real potential problem for Angela Rayner. Angela Rayner is separated now, but she was married to a guy. And before she married to that guy, she owned her own house. She had her own children. And the question is whether in tax law and also in electoral law, if she declared the address that she was actually living at, she claims that she didn't live with her husband, that she lived in her own house a mile down the road and her husband lived up the road in his house. So she was able to claim capital gains tax relief on her own house, and that's where she was, you know, registered for electoral purposes. But all the neighbours say she didn't live there, that she lived up the road with the husband. And this all came out in a book by Lord Ashcroft, and the Tories have jumped on it as evidence that Angela Rayner, who really hammered Boris Johnson over Partygate, that's why they really have an in for her, I think. And they've said that, look, that she you know, they have accused her of not telling the truth. She claims that she is telling the truth. And I suppose it all comes down to whether or not Angela Rayner is telling porkies about where she lived or where she didn't. A small issue has become potentially a very, very big issue, with, it seems, the potential, at least, to cost her her position as deputy leader of the Labour Party, and with it, the potential cost of Deputy Prime Minister of the UK, which is what she would become after the election if Labour wins. She would become Labour's new John Prescott, this working class champion to sort of smooth out the sort of lawyerly edges of Keir Starmer, or perhaps to roughen up the lawyerly edges of Keir Starmer. It would seem an enormous price to pay for putting the wrong address on a few forms. She is a certain type of politician, a kind of a... And she's not just a working class politician, but she's very open about her working class background. She's the type of politician that I think perhaps British politics needs more of, a kind of a really feisty woman who has fought her way to the top. But she seems, I wouldn't completely discount this issue. I do think she's in quite a bit of trouble. There's a police investigation now into what actually happened with the addresses and so on, because, it is an offence to have the wrong addresses for electoral law for so on. So look, we'll see what comes out of that. If it drags on, it's going to continue to do damage to her anyway. She's certainly weakened at the moment.
Looking at it again from outside, I mean, the sums of money we're talking about are really very small, I think it should be said. Now, if somebody tells an untruth, they tell an untruth, and that should have political consequences. But I think the amount of, money that might have been saved by this was sort of £1,500 or something of that sort. And as you say, she comes from a very different background from certainly the most of the MPs on the other side of the house, and probably most of the MPs on our own side of the house as well. She was a single mother at 16, came from a very, very troubled family, started working in the care industry, became a trade union official. She's exactly the kind of politician you would think Britain needs more of. And she has been a kind of a lightning rod for the Tories, hasn't she? Because she's pretty abrasive as well. I have to admit, I have a lot of sympathy for her in this situation.
Yeah, I do have a lot of sympathy for her. I mean, I was at a lunch that Angela Rayner was at about two to 3 weeks ago, actually maybe a couple more, maybe it's about 4 weeks ago. It was just before the Easter recess, and it was when this problem was really bubbling up, and she became quite emotional at that lunch. She was very much on the verge of tears when she was questioned about it by media present. It was a press gallery lunch. There was probably 25 journalists plus Angela Rayner in a room, basically. She was giving a speech on her politics, a kind of a comedy speech almost, in a sense, a little bit like a White House correspondence dinner kind of a speech. But she got very emotional. And she said, look, this whole thing is just a smear campaign against me because I'm a working class woman. It's invading the privacy of my children. It's very upsetting. I didn't do anything wrong. And the people walking out of that lunch walked out in two camps. One camp who said, yeah, look, this is terrible. Just leave the woman alone. And the other camp were saying, well, that seemed like a kind of a performance by her inside in that lunch. And that if she actually has been telling mistruths, that in and of itself is a big, big issue. If you look back to her performance during Partygate and Boris Johnson being at parties in Downing Street and so on, a lot of Tories still believe that was a small issue. And that Angela Rayner drummed that up and made it into a big issue by saying, look, if you've made even the slightest, tiniest mistake, Boris Johnson has got to go. And Partygate was what eventually kind of drove him out of office. And they're saying this is a miniature version of that. I have some sympathy for Angela Rayner as well, but I do think the issue of whether or not she has been telling the truth and goes to the heart of this as well, because if she wants to be Deputy Prime Minister of the country, if she's found to have not told the truth, and by that, even though it's only £3,500 worth of capital gains tax, and even though it's only a couple of misfilled out electoral roll forms, I do think that is an issue in and of itself. It's like, look, I don't know, she says she's telling the truth, and I haven't seen any evidence that Angela Rayner is lying, but if she isn't telling the truth, and maybe she's gone so far down the road that she thinks that she can't tell the truth now, that I think could be what catches her out in the end, if indeed she's caught out. But look, she may survive wounded and become the next Deputy Prime Minister, and all this might be in the rearview mirror in a few months' time.
I mean, regardless of what happens, it seems clear that, barring some absolutely extraordinary eventuality, Labour are going to have a comfortable majority after that general election whenever it comes. I look at, and I'm sure you do too, some of the extrapolations based on the current opinion polls, and they give an extraordinarily large majority to Labour, and they also predict the absolute decimation of the Conservatives down to barely more than 100 seats in the Commons. When you talk to people in Westminster, do they think that that could happen or is likely to happen?
Well, with the UK's first past the post system, you just never know. And one small issue, like migration or something like that, can have a real big impact late in the day. But look, all of the polls are showing, the Tory party's at least 20 points behind in percentage terms, and which gives a range of just below 100 seats up to about maybe 160 or so. They're definitely, they look like they're on course for a kind of a 1997 style drubbing. Labour needs a 12.5% swing in the polls just to win by one seat. And, polls when you talk to people in Westminster, and you know, I sat down for breakfast recently with Lord Hayward, who's seen as the biggest kind of expert in the Tory party in all these polls. He said polls always narrow a little bit closer, that perhaps there's a chance that that Labour's majority mightn't be quite as big as it looks now. But look, you never know. You just never know in these things. I don't know. I don't know what the polls are or what the election is going to turn out exactly in terms of seats. I mean, there is quite a wide range in the polls, but the Tories are on course for a hiding. There's no doubt about that. They're on course for an absolute hiding. And I suppose just the size of Keir Starmer and Labour's majority is really just what's that question here, you know?
I mean, one of the things that really strikes me about this is, I mean, you weren't in place in London at this stage, but I mean, I recall, you know, three and a half years ago, Boris Johnson was sort of in his pomp. Keir Starmer didn't seem to be making any inroads into the Conservative Party lead. It was received wisdom in the political establishment that the Labour project of getting it back into power would have to be a two-election project. Such was the scale of the challenge of the swing. And then everything changed utterly. And I wonder, as well as, you know, perhaps casting light on some of the individual things that have happened in British politics over the last 2 years, it illustrates something that we see in politics in many countries these days, which is a huge increase in volatility in the electorate as well.
Yes, look, the electorate has simply just changed his mind. Look, there is Keir Starmer's competent management of his party and the fact that he's dampened down all of the divisions. There is the fact that the Tories have been tearing themselves apart. But there is also in the background, and perhaps this is maybe just my own theory, but related to the B word and to Brexit, a lot of polling shows now that some people who voted for Brexit regret it. And I think maybe a lot of people who voted Tory, how do you express that? There isn't another Brexit vote where you get to vote again. So how do you express this sense of regret for voting for Brexit? And I think some of them will do it for the next general election. They associate Brexit as a Tory project. And if you regret Brexit and you voted Tory the last time, well, you're not going to vote Tory this time. And that's how you get that out of your system. So there has been this, you know, this enormous pivot in the British electorate. It's clear that enough voters, you know, beyond the kind of core ultras of each party, enough swing voters and enough moderate voters have decided they've had enough of the Tory party, that they're tired, that they want them out. And there's just been this massive change in the mind of the British electorate, which we're likely to see played out in the election, whether that election is held in June or July or whether it's held in October or November. Yeah, it's a cliche, but it really is a change period in British politics. And, you know, the turmoil of Brexit and the turmoil of the pandemic and all the rest of it is finished. But the political turmoil and the ramifications of that are still going on. And maybe this issue just needs to be finally put to bed in the minds of the British electorate by just making an enormous switch to Labour and a fresh start.
We're going to take a very quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about what's happening north of the border in Scotland.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And you're very welcome back. Mark Paul is still here with me. Mark, Scottish politics are very different from English politics, and the way that the UK constitution works these days, you know, certain issues, certain competencies are delegated to Edinburgh and away from London. And all the dynamics are very different. In some ways, looking at the Scottish political landscape, which is probably even more turbulent than the English one at the moment, it's kind of halfway between London and Dublin. There are parts of the landscape that would look more familiar to Irish people. You have a coalition government which involves the Greens. You have controversies over issues like a hate crime bill. Are there parallels there at all?
Yes, there are. I mean, you've got in the Scottish National Party, the SNP, you've got a party that's been in for a long time in power, just like the Tories, I suppose, have down in London and just like Fine Gael have in Dublin. You've got a party that looks tired. You've got a party that's in a coalition now. I suppose, unlike Dublin, where the coalition with the Green Party is quite stable, the coalition in Scotland between the SNP and the Greens is quite an item of controversy and it's causing some political instability up there. The Green Party are seen by a lot of SNP traditionalists as dragging the Scottish government and the SNP too far to the left, and that the Green Party is the tail wagging the dog. And, you know, I mean, they had trouble over there over a bottle return scheme, for example, which is another parallel with Dublin. But there's now, this week, there's a vote of no confidence in the Green leader, a guy called Patrick Harvey. And he has said that if the Bute House Agreement, which is the coalition agreement between the SNP and the Greens, that he'll step down as leader if there's any threat to that sort of a thing. It's all very unmanageable for Humza Youssef, who is the leader who came in place of Nicola Sturgeon. And he hasn't had a very good time of it because he's had to face scandal after scandal, in fact, not at all of his own making, and to try and manage all of those things. He's also in a very, very difficult position. There's a lot of different plates in the air there. I mean, if you look at, for example, after Nicola Sturgeon left power, and I know we've spoken about this before, I mean, there was a kind of a financial scandal. And, you know, in recent weeks, her husband has been charged with allegations of embezzlement of SNP funds. That's something that really came along and slapped Humza Yousaf in the face, and there's not a lot that he can do about that. There's another political problem brewing for Humza Yousaf this week, in that he's put forward a bill, or his government has put forward a bill, to have juryless rape trials. And there's actually been quite an SNP rebellion on that, and it looks like at some stage the SNP government might be defeated on that. Another, I suppose, problem for Humza Yousaf, an image problem, and again not of his own making, is that his brother-in-law has been charged in connection with a case in Dundee where a man fell to his death from a high building. Now, obviously, that has nothing to do, you know, in real terms, with Humza Yousaf, but it's another thing that he's had to talk about and that he's been asked about in the media. And all of this coalesces around the fact that the SNP, a little bit like the Tories in London, are a party that are probably tired from a long period in government in Scotland. They're probably going to come to the end of the road as the largest Scottish party in Westminster. And they're probably going to come to the end of the road as the third largest party in Westminster, full stop. And then the next elections for Holyrood, for the devolved parliament, are in 2026. And that's the real test. That's the real power base for the SNP. And it'll be interesting to see if Humza Yousaf is able to hang on until then if he has a really bad Westminster election later on this year.
I suppose one of the questions I've always wondered about the SNP is, what kind of a party is it? Is it a party of the left or the right? I think it started as a relatively conservative nationalist party, and then it kind of shifted to the kind of progressive left over the last 10 or 15 years or so. But in a way, again, an Irish parallel, you know, its main objective is Scottish independence, and it's a sort of a catch-all party for anybody who believes in that.
That's it. I mean, independence is the kind of central pole that holds up the entire tent. And then beneath that tent, you have all sorts, from the left to the right, from traditionalists to I suppose, people who might be disparaged by their critics as the woke. All of those people. Under Nicola Sturgeon's leadership, when she was First Minister of Scotland, the party did tack very much to the left on social issues. That really excited their young activists. That was really where the SNP's power was driven, particularly after it lost the 2014 independence referendum. Young activists really got involved in the party, really energised. And these were the people who are really interested in transgender issues, in the environment and ecological issues, and in workers' rights and all of these kind of, I suppose, left-wing issues. And there's a feeling now that perhaps the party is running out of road on that side, and it's tacking back a little bit more towards the centre. Something that I found very interesting when I was spending some time in Scotland earlier on this year, up around the northeast of Scotland and Aberdeen and those kind of areas, was that the SNP was cuddling back up to the oil industry again a little bit in around the Aberdeen area. And it was actually getting some profit in the polls for itself on this. You know, Aberdeen is obviously the oil drilling capital of Europe, but obviously oil is bad for the environment. But there's a lot of people in that area of Scotland, the wealthiest part of Scotland, who rely on it for work and for income. And the SNP was cuddling back up to the industry again, was talking about the rules around North Sea drilling, about those being loosened again and so on. So look, it's the SNP is tacking back to the centre or to the right a little bit. How that impacts upon these energised young activists, will they still come out and canvass for the party in the elections? I don't know if they will in the same numbers as before. And then there's the issue of Humza Yousaf himself, who I've met a few times. You know, he's quite a suave, confident, urbane, good speaker. But do the Scottish electorate really like him? Have they really taken to him? I think that's still in question. And when you talk to seasoned, far more seasoned than me, analysts of Scottish politics, they'll tell you that that's a real issue, that the Scottish electorate still hasn't really taken to Humza Yousaf as an individual, as a leader. And that's going to be a problem for the SNP too.
So the Scottish government abandoned its carbon reduction targets, supposed to get to a certain point, I think quite ambitious targets, which it had agreed with its Green partners to get to by 2030. Does that mean that the Greens are going to pull out? And are some of those other issues that you talked about, for example, the transgender issue, the implementation possibly of the CAS review on a change in approach to youth transgender medicine, which applied the CAS review solely to England, but I gather it's also been adopted by NHS Scotland?
Yes. Well, what the NHS in Scotland has said, they will go off and they will review the CAS review in a sense. I mean, health and health policy is one of those devolved issues that's actually in the gift of the Scottish government and the Scottish system. Up there. So the Scottish government has said it will go off and it will review the CAS review. So I don't think that there's a full commitment yet to implement every last part of it.
Sorry, I should correct myself. But what the NHS Scotland has said is suspending those treatments pending that review.
Yes, pending that review. The transgender issue, I suppose, to use a kind of a trite catch-all description for those very, very complex series of issues. But the transgender issue has been quite a spicy issue in Scotland for a while. The Greens have described it as a kind of a bit of a deal-breaker for the Bute House Agreement, that if there was any real rollback on transgender rights issues in Scotland, as there has been in England, that they would walk away from government. But within the SNP party, it has been quite divisive. Ash Regan, who was one of the contenders for the SNP leadership with Huns of Youth of last year, I mean, she effectively left the party over this. J.K. Rowling, who is also Scottish, she's been quite vocal on this in Scotland and causing problems for them. So it's seen again as one of those culture war issues where the Greens in Scotland drag the SNP to the left and not always to the same place where all the SNP's voters were. So it's a troublesome issue up there in Scotland. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of this review. The CAS review overall, Hugh, I don't know if you're detecting this from Ireland, but it's been, I just think the way it's been received in Britain overall is very, very strange. It's as if there has been suddenly this vindication of everything that all of J.K. Rowling's supporters over the years have said. And I just don't think that's quite what the CAS review finds. I think the CAS review makes some very, very sober recommendations in terms of health policy around young people and being careful and so on. I think one crowd have taken this and are waving it in the air like the FA Cup as if they've just won the entire argument hands down. But, you know, as perhaps you know and as a lot of other people know, these issues are far, far, far more complex. And they have the ability to cause real problems for politicians in Scotland and beyond.
Indeed. And one would guess as well that north of the border, as well as we already discussed in England, that the issues that most preoccupy voters are actually bread and butter issues about the economy, the health system, you know, social services, those types of things. And on your many trips to Scotland, I mean, is there a sense of how good a job, you know, Scottish government is doing on those? You see numbers sometimes about, you know, the level of drug problems in Scotland, the quality of the education system, questions about the economy. To what extent are they at the forefront of what people are talking about?
I think those are at the forefront of voters' minds, and they're also at the forefront of a lot of people in the SNP's minds who think that the party should focus not less on independence, but certainly less on independence as its single issue and more on convincing the Scottish people that governing is their thing. I mean, you're right when you say to look at those statistics, there are some issues in Scotland. I mean, certainly the drug problem in Scotland in terms of the statistics around that are awful. But they've also had some successes in comparison to England and Scotland. I mean, for example, in Scotland, they have something much closer to our children's allowance or our child benefit system, the kind of Scottish child payment, which is a real success of theirs, which has lifted an awful lot of families and children out of poverty in Scotland. And those statistics are actually better in Scotland than they are in England. The Scottish NHS comes in for a little bit of stick down in Westminster from the Tory government, who say it's an example of what would happen. They say that it's run in a worse fashion up there, and that it's an example of what would happen if there was independence. And then, yeah, look, there are issues around in the, education and then the economy as a whole, although their unemployment figures aren't vastly different from England. And if you go to actually parts of Northern England, they're much more destitute, I think, than parts of Scotland. But yeah, certainly the Scottish government under the SNP has had a mixed bag in terms of its governance on these issues over the years. And it was one of those issues in actually the leadership campaign last year. I mean, Kate Forbes, the vanquished second place challenger, her whole point, her whole argument was, look, you know, obviously independence is our long-term aim, but we've got to convince the Scottish people that we're good governors as well, and maybe we should focus on the knitting and the day-to-day issues for a while. And Humza Yousaf's charge, of course, was that independence will fix everything. So these wounds goons in the SNP, these fishers, you know, they haven't narrowed since the leadership campaign. If anything, they've gotten wider. And, you know, this thing about juryless rape trials this week and the SNP rebellion over that, Kay Forbes was one of the rebels on that, just shows that those fishers aren't closing up at all. And an interesting time ahead in Scottish politics, and perhaps a gap for Keir Starmer and the Labour Party and Anna Sarwar, the very, very competent Scottish Labour leader, to drive some kind of measure of success through.
Well, indeed, and that brings us around to where we started, which is the Westminster elections. And one of the things that was thought 4 or 5 years ago of why it would be so difficult for Labour to return to power was because Scotland, which had always been a stronghold, had been lost to the SNP. And because of the first-past-the-post system, it hadn't just lost some seats, it had basically been wiped out in terms of seat representation at Westminster. And that looks like that's going to be reversed, doesn't it, when the general election happens?
Yes, I think Labour are in a good position to once again become the biggest Westminster party in Scotland. They're looking, they're hoping to take about 25 seats off the, is it 49 Scottish Westminster seats. They're hoping to take about 25 of those off the SNP. And there's two schools of thought on that. One school of thought, which is that, you know, look, the polls are right and that they're on course to do this. The other one is that perhaps the demise of the SNP is a little bit exaggerated. I suppose it depends on what constituency you go to. I spent actually quite a bit of time recently up in the Outer Hebrides, a really, really interesting constituency for a whole variety of reasons. It's that archipelago of islands kind of scattered to the northwest of Scotland. It's Protestant in its top half. It's staunchly Catholic in its bottom half. Since 2005, the MP there has been the SNP's Angus Brendan McNeill. But, you know, kind of as a microcosm of the splits in the SNP, he's quit the party. He's running again as an independent. And through this gap, you have the Labour Party looks set to reclaim that seat. A guy called Turkle Crichton, a former journalist, actually a former Westminster journalist, who looks like he's going to reclaim the Outer Hebrides, or Nehillinan an Oighear, as the constituency is called in Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic. He's going to reclaim that for Labour. And if Turkle Crichton reclaims that seat for Labour, as it looks like, I mean, that's a good harbinger of a good election for Labour in Scotland. And if they get those 25 seats, it'll certainly help to bolster whatever majority Keir Starmer ends up with. There was a mode of thinking at one stage last year that he might need to win all of those 25 seats in order to get any sort of a majority in the UK. But it looks like he should get a majority without Scotland. But yeah, Labour are back on for some sort of a renewal in Scotland of some degree, yeah.
Mark, I have to say, I admire the way you've taken us from the corridors of Westminster to the Outer Hebrides in the course of one overview of UK politics. I couldn't have asked for a better overview of what's happening and what's likely to happen over the next while. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Hugh.
That's it for today. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We'll be back with you with the Friday Wrap. Until then, thanks very much for listening.